Hello, I'm Merrick Schneider. Welcome to this podcast of articles from the Wall Street Journal, a presentation of AIRS LA. You are listening to this recording, which is provided for the use of those who are blind or print impaired. Materials or items read on AIRS LA are the copyrighted property of the original authors and publishers. No unauthorized use or duplication is permitted. Today's first article is by Natasha Khan, titled $9.99 Prices Still Make Sense for Hard-Pressed Retailers. Then Scott Atlas wrote, "The selfie generation is the baby boomer's mistake." We'll follow that up with an article, "State Farm's AI Makeover Meets Resistance," by Gene Inglesham. Ronald Fryer wrote, "Economics of Friendship," and then we do have one more by Emma Rosenblum, "The 40s, That Used to Be Old, Not Anymore." All these articles are from recent editions of the Wall Street Journal. So let's begin with today's first one, $9.99 prices still make sense for hard-pressed retailers. There's a magic number that makers of everyday goods are obsessed with. $9.99. Just a penny more and shoppers start to turn away. Keeping prices under $10 has long been a strategy used by United States retailers. It is a tried and true price point that encourages people to switch brands and try new products, from soap to soda, pain relievers to party favors. And it's more important than ever, with many Americans feeling stretched by inflation. But it is getting harder for companies to keep products under that price point. Higher fuel prices, tariffs, and other factors are driving up the cost for making products. That is forcing many companies to drive hard bargains and sacrifice profit margins to hold prices below the psychologically important $10 threshold. Michaels, the craft store chain, is redesigning store layouts to expand its selection of its under $10 offerings. Toy maker Hasbro has simplified packaging for its action figures and board games. Boston Beer began offering twisted teas that come in a 4-pack instead of a 6-pack. Walmart cut the price of 24 packs of Coke and Pepsi to just under $10 in a summer promotion announced last week. And upstart brands looking to grow are settling for lower margins and cutting marketing budgets in hopes they can attract new shoppers with price tags that start with a 9. $9.99 is a real price point that drives a lot of consumer behavior, said Chris Cox, the chief executive of Hasbro. He calls it a snackable price, great for a quick treat, a gift, or a little show of love or appreciation. Hasbro has redoubled efforts to meet the 9.99 price point, working with designers and suppliers to cut product packaging costs, he said. It now sells its Kinect 4 game in a sleeve rather than a box. Packaging for its Transformers Cyber Changer action figures have been simplified. And the new World Cup edition of its Monopoly Deal card game comes with no packaging at all. The case that holds the cards does the job on its own. Rival toy company Spin Master, meanwhile, credits advances in automation for helping it streamline its manufacturing process for a modernized version of its Rubik's Cube it is introducing later this year. The new process helps the cube rotate more smoothly and keeps the price under $10. The appeal of prices like $9.99 is not about saving a penny, said Vicki Morwitz, a professor of marketing at the Columbia Business School in New York. Consumers tend to categorize prices into ranges, so having a price be under $10 can feel different than a price that is $10 and above, even when the actual monetary difference is negligible. As inflation has pushed many everyday prices above familiar thresholds, Products that remain below those thresholds may stand out more than before, she said. While fans of craft beer are often willing to pay more, consumers of Boston's beer's hard twisted tea are so sensitive to that sub $10 price point that the company made a 4-pack of 16-ounce cans. Chief Executive Jim Koch said that the 6-pack pricing for 12-ounce cans had gotten over $10, so this gives us an entry point. The majority of the products at Michael's, the craft store, are already under $10, but the company is looking to increase its offerings below that price by an additional 10% by the end of the year. Chief Merchandising Officer Stacy Shibley said the accessible price point allows for customers to add fun to their shopping trip while staying within their budget. Companies that sell certain products on Amazon have an added incentive to keep their prices below $10. In the baby products, beauty, health, and personal care categories, the e-commerce giant charges an 8% referral fee for items that sell for $10 or less, compared with a fee that can reach $15 for items that cross that threshold. Carlin Consumer Health CEO James Barrickman said Amazon's fee structure was a key consideration when it introduced its Mineral Ice Extreme Cooling Pain Reliever with a $9.99 price tag in June. Standing out against bigger competitors is why Ryan Lutberger, the co-founder and CEO of natural cleaning product company Clean Coat, has not raised prices in 7 years, even though holding the line has shrunk his profit margins. When its competitors often price hand soap refills at $10.99 or $11.99, Clean Coat, which packages its cleaners in milk carton-like containers to avoid using plastic, has intentionally kept some of its products at $7.99. Whataburger says that price drives newcomers to try the product, and it regularly sets discounts for its laundry detergent to reduce the price from about $12.99 to just under $9.99. When it does so, sales more than double. When shoppers see a price that starts with a 10 instead of a 9, that's a very, very different price experience. Immediately, you're going to think that's expensive because your brain doesn't process the number, said Lutberger. And now, the selfie generation is the baby boomers' mistake. My story is not unique. All four of my grandparents came to this country in the early 20th century from England, Poland, and Russia with nothing. Less than nothing. No money, no connections, no guarantees. Some lost family members they came with in the chaos at Ellis Island. They all learned English on their own and spoke it fluently, not because they were required to, but because they were proud to do so. They had immigrated to become Americans. That was the whole point. Love for this country ran in my family. When the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor, the 17-year-old who would become my father lied about his age to enlist in the Marines. For the men of his generation, that was the gut reaction. Today, polls show a majority of Democrats say they are not proud to be American. My father came back from war and scrambled to find work. After marrying my mom, he worked 3 jobs, including driving a taxi on the midnight shift, so that his son could be the first in our family to go to college. One night, he fell asleep at the wheel, crashed, and was thrown through the windshield. I woke up to find him in a hospital bed in our basement, bandaged and recovering from several broken ribs. Through it all, he never asked whether the system was fair. He did not look to Washington for a handout. He drove through the night so we could have a better morning. I got my education with the help of a part-time pizza delivery job, merit scholarships, and loans. Loans I was thrilled to take and proud to pay back in full. That's how opportunity was supposed to work. You reached for it, you used it, and you honored the obligation. I became a physician, then a professor and chief of neuroradiology at Stanford, and eventually a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution. By many measures, I joined the so-called elite, but I've always been the outsider in those rooms. Most of my colleagues grew up with educated parents, affluent households, and connections. I did not. The difference shapes whether you see success as an entitlement or as yours to create. My generation, the baby boomers, made a catastrophic mistake. We watched our parents sacrifice, we struggled to move up, and we vowed our children would have it easier. When that time came, we gave them trophies for showing up. We meant well, but in freeing them of the need to struggle, we deprived them of something essential. We raised a generation insulated from failure, from consequence, from the experience of working for something, failing, and trying again. The result is visible in major American cities, where young voters are electing socialist candidates who spew hatred of those who achieve greatness. These movements are not about creating opportunity. They're about grievance, redistribution, and the conviction that your own failures are the result of someone else's success. It's a politics of envy dressed up as justice. The hallmark of today's young generation is the selfie, a photo of yourself taken and posted for the approval of others. That says everything. And when the world does not deliver the validation young people have been told they deserve simply for existing, the explanation is always the same. The system is rigged, the deck is stacked, someone else has too much. My grandparents never asked whether the deck was stacked. Of course they had disadvantages. They were dirt poor immigrants who spoke no English in a new country. They built anyway. The appeal of socialism to young Americans is not really about economics. It's about having someone else to blame. When you have not succeeded after being given every advantage, it's easier to claim the system is unfair than to admit personal failure. What's tragic is that the narrative of societal unfairness is being sold as compassionate. It is not. It is condescension packaged as solidarity. It tells young people they are victims, incapable of rising, dependent on redistribution, owed a life they have not earned. It robs them of the one thing my father's midnight taxi shift gave me, the knowledge that I could do it myself. My grandparents came here for opportunity, not guaranteed outcomes. My father eagerly defended his country without asking for anything in return. I am not nostalgic for poverty or for war. My family's sacrifices were real costs, not romantic ones. But what came out of that hardship, the self-reliance, the drive, the refusal to accept helplessness, was not incidental to who they were. It was the whole of it. We have abandoned the uniquely American idea that you must earn what you get. We need to restore that belief before the generation we indulged forgets it forever. And now, State Farm's AI, artificial intelligence makeover, meets resistance. A State Farm agent in Illinois was excited to try a state-of-the-art device the insurer is rolling out to its sales force. The AI tool promises an instant summary of each customer's household. But the agent said its date for when she became a policyholder was wrong by almost two decades. It also incorrectly showed her as having been late on a payment. Good luck with the AI, she thought. State Farm is embarking on an AI makeover, giving technology tools to agents and more online services to customers. The nation's biggest home insurer hopes its human plus digital strategy will future-proof its market dominance. The 104-year-old company's attempt to leapfrog into the 21st century is running into resistance from its agents and customers. More than 1,000 State Farm customers and agents responded to a recent Wall Street Journal article on its plans. The responses show the challenges the Bloomington Illinois insurer faces in its quest to embrace AI. State Farm maintains a network of 19,000 agent offices in most states. The insurer said it is not aiming to replace agents with AI, but it expects the changes to result in larger agencies, suggesting smaller offices may consolidate or close. Many readers who responded to the journal's accepted AI upending of insurance sales as inevitable. Some hoped it would ease price increases. "We've been hammered by rate increases for years," said Danny Bissett of Milwaukee. "Leaner means increased affordability." But few welcomed the prospect of more automation. Chatbots and other automated systems are a pain to deal with, judging by the 900 or so customers who responded to the journal. "Terrible," "infuriating," and "it sucks" were common descriptions. Several said they would switch insurers if their agent's office shut as a result of the changes. The reasons we've stuck with State Farm is the great service by the local agent, said Joe Funk of Morristown, New Jersey. "I didn't have to spend 10 minutes shouting representative into the phone." State Farm agents who responded and who did not want to be named for fear of being fired worried about the chances that AI would not work well given the insurer's record on tech innovations. "State Farm is a great insurance company," an agent in Alabama said. "We're a horrible tech company." The complaints included computers that hang up on agents and customers at busy times, outdated software, and slow, clunky claims and billing systems. Agents are justifiably concerned about the dependability and reliability of State Farm's technology, said Robert E. O'Connor, Jr., general counsel at the National Association of State Farm Agents, which represents the sales force. "Over the last 10 years, everything that's been rolled out has had issues. There have been a lot of outages." A State Farm spokesman said that as a mutual company owned by its policyholders, the insurer makes technology investments based on what's right for our customers over the long term, not simply how quickly we can bring new capabilities to market. The company continually gathers feedback from agents, employees, and customers to refine its tech capabilities, he added. Agents said the insurer's tech, instead of freeing up their time to sell more, can result in them having to sort out glitches. "Seems the more State Farm tries, the more work it creates for the agent's office," said Tom Duffy, a recently retired agent in Mesa, Arizona. AI will most likely not be any different. Others who wrote in complained the AI technology can go stale rapidly. A State Farm ChatGPT style tool for agents has a knowledge cutoff of last year, according to screenshots reviewed by the journal. State Farm spokesman said, "Success is not measured by how many tools we launch. It is measured by whether we can make it easier for agents and employees to serve customers. Agents can choose if they want to use the AI tool giving data on customer households, and 93% opted to do so," the spokesman added. "Not all customers who contacted us are unhappy about AI. Chris Tynan in St. Louis said AI-driven cuts to insurance agents' compensation were a painful necessity. "We no longer have switchboard operators or elevator operators," Tynan added. "Commission sales reps have their days numbered." State Farm is, if anything, late to an industry race to use the new tech. Allstate, for example, is piloting direct sales done entirely by AI in three states, Chief Executive Tom Wilson told investors back in April. Allstate has given agents an AI customer engagement sidekick to listen in and advise on their calls, he said. A spokesman for Allstate declined to name the states where the AI tool is selling. State Farm rolled back one element of its AI-driven sales overhaul after the uproar over the changes to agents' contracts. a retirement-style benefit that was being axed will continue through 2031, subject to a baseline performance expectation, according to an email to agents reviewed by the journal. But the message said executives remain confident in the direction they were taking. The competitive landscape is changing, the email added. Standing still is not an option. And now, the economic of friendship. The ferry crossing from Chappaquiddick to Edgerton, Massachusetts is only 527 feet long. But no matter how rich or important you are, you have to wait to get on the boat. Sometimes you wait in your car, sometimes you get out. Someone complains about the line, the weather, our politics, or the UPS driver goes to the front of the queue. Someone else laughs. A conversation begins. This is not a defense of bad maritime logistics, but spending time around that ferry has made me wonder if modern life has undersold inconvenience. We treat waiting as wasted time. Often it is. But sometimes waiting does something useful. It forces people into the same place with nothing to do long enough for conversation to begin. That may sound trivial. It is not. Loneliness has become one of the stranger problems of modern life. Back in 2023, the United States Surgeon General called loneliness and social isolation a public health problem. About half of American adults have reported experiencing loneliness. The World Health Organization describes social disconnection as a global health challenge affecting roughly 1 in 6 people worldwide. In several Western countries, self-reported loneliness among young adults appears to have risen over the past 4 or 5 decades. Young adults report more loneliness than middle-aged or older adults. In 2010 research, Julianne Holt-Lundstedt and her co-authors pooled evidence from 148 studies and found that weak social relationships predict mortality at a magnitude comparable to smoking and greater than obesity or physical inactivity. Loneliness has been linked to higher risk of cardiovascular disease, dementia, stroke, depression, anxiety, and premature death. These estimates are not from randomized trials, and loneliness isn't a pill with a known dosage, but they make one intuitive point hard to escape. Social connection is part of a healthy life. Which brings me back to the ridiculously inconvenient ferry, what I call the friction theory of friendship. The idea is simple. Some inconveniences are not merely costs. They are hidden scaffolding of social life. If I had to estimate my own production function for friendship, it would look something like this. Friendship equals proximity times repetition, plus idle time times low stakes, and shared irritation. Proximity matters most when it recurs. Idle time matters most when nobody is trying to impress anyone. Shared irritation helps, but with diminishing returns. A delayed ferry creates conversation. A broken ferry creates rage. This is why friendship is often a product of something else. Work, school, church, children, sports, errands, waiting rooms. It is produced not by misery, but by enough common friction to make conversation natural. Modern life has spent decades eliminating that friction. We can work without offices, shop without stores, exercise without gyms, and communicate without looking anyone in the eye. Each improvement is defensible, some phenomenal. Together, they have made interaction with other people increasingly optional. I'm the last person who should be moralizing about convenience. I almost never go to the grocery store. There's too much waiting. I order food delivery as often as my wife will tolerate. Our daughters love takeout, and I get to keep working. I gave up the gym for a Peloton. Even my walk home from work has to be productive. I don't begin until I have started a deep research query on whichever artificial intelligent assistant I am in love with that week. The joke is on me. I used to meet interesting people in line at the gym on the walk home in the small delays that interrupted my day. I don't anymore. I have optimized away the moments in which friendship used to appear. The last few friction-filled places in my life, the only places I have made friends in the past couple of years, are that annoying ferry line, fishing, and on the sidelines of my kids' soccer games. Even there, I tried to work when my kid was subbed out. The other parents kept interrupting, so eventually I gave up. Can we prove that the pursuit of frictionless living has contributed to an unattended loneliness epidemic? Not easily, but the data fits better than I expected. Using state-level loneliness measures from the United States Census Bureau's Household Pulse Survey, I compared loneliness with three proxies for modern convenience: working from home, broadband-enabled living, and the share of commuters who still move through public or pedestrian space. States where more daily life can be conducted privately, at home, online, on a screen, tend to report somewhat more loneliness. States where more people commute by public transportation or walking tend to report less. Places built around private convenience look lonelier than places where daily routines force people to bump into one another. After accounting for age, income, and who lives alone, the relationship weakens but remains statistically significant. This is not definitive, but it points in a direction the theory predicts. When the ordinary logistics of life no longer require us to encounter one another, the ties that begin in those encounters become harder to form. Why hasn't the market solved this? Economic has markets for seemingly everything: marriage, labor, education, housing, therapy, entertainment, even sex. But there is no clean market for friendship. That is not because friendship lacks value. It is because friendship is hard to sell directly. A friend is not simply a person with similar interests. Friendship requires trust, recurrence, reciprocity, and time. It is difficult to verify in advance and awkward to purchase explicitly. The moment one says, "I am here to buy friendship," the thing becomes purchased changes. Markets are powerful when the good is clear, the price is observable, and the transaction is socially acceptable. Friendship fails on all three margins. That is why friendship is usually produced indirectly. People go to school to learn, to the office to earn a living, and to the ferry line to get to the other side. Yet these settings solve the hardest problem in friendship formation: proximity multiplied by repetition. They put the same people in the same place often enough that a conversation can become a relationship. Search theory offers a useful way to think about this. In labor markets, workers and firms do not match instantly because information is incomplete and search is costly. Potential friends are everywhere. Good matches are hard to find. And unlike a labor market, there is no resume for a good friend. Institutions reduce those search costs. The office hallway lowers the cost of a first conversation. The school pickup line does the same. So do the church basement, the neighborhood barbecue, the youth sports sideline, and the ferry queue. They put us near one another often enough that trust can accumulate without anyone having to announce that trust is the goal. The usual response is to blame phones. That is too easy. The deeper force is the war on friction. Remote work, delivery apps, online shopping, online banking, self-checkout, telemedicine, and private exercise platforms each solve a real problem. But they also remove tiny moments of shared dependence. The solution is not to make life harder for its own sake. Pointless hassle is still pointless. But as technology redesigns schools, workplaces, neighborhoods, and commerce, we should ask what social infrastructure is being lost. Schools, for example, are not only human capital institutions. They are social capital institutions. So making them hyper-individualized and efficient has costs. Workplaces are similar. The goal is not to abolish remote work, but to recognize the company as valued. Cities should build and preserve libraries, parks, playgrounds, walkable streets, and mixed-use spaces as amenities and places where low-stakes contact can happen. It is a mistake to think of social life as something individuals can solve alone. Much of what we call community used to be produced by institutions as a byproduct. That is why I've come to love the Chappaquiddick ferry. It is inefficient in almost every measurable way. It creates lines, it wastes time, it forces strangers into proximity. It gives people nothing to do for a few minutes except notice one another. Convenience has saved us time. The hidden price is that it also has saved us from one another. And we do have one more. The 40s. That used to be old, not anymore. Last week, the actress Anne Hathaway attended the London premiere of The Odyssey in a flowy blue gown from Dior. "Turn a little bit sideways," a photographer asked, and Hathaway laughed and complied, cradling her stomach proudly. Hathaway, 43, had recently announced her pregnancy on Instagram with the caption, "X baby, I'm yours, X." Back in April, Natalie Portman, 45, also shared that she was pregnant. "I know it's such a privilege and a miracle," she said to Harper's Bazaar, "and knowing it's probably the last time, I cherish every moment." Even 10 years ago, such news would have caused a stir, with speculation about fertility treatments and hand-wringing over advanced maternal age. But with some exceptions, these two announcements generated little beyond congratulations, remarkable only for being unremarkable. When I was a teenager, my best friend's mom had a caboose baby, her fourth child, at 42. This was the 90s, and I remember how surprising it seemed that she was pregnant when she was already so old. Back then, being in your 40s meant that your life was, for the most part, settled. If you were married, you had older kids. If you worked, you were going to stay at your job until retirement. Any disruption of those norms felt like a newsworthy event. "And I'm going to be 40, said Sally's famous line from 1989, "When Harry Met Sally." "When," Harry replies. "Someday," Sally said, panicked at the thought of it. Now, the standard playbook has changed entirely. A woman's 40s are now considered a dynamic and changeable era, as many of the so-called traditional milestones, home ownership, career, children, have been pushed later for personal, societal, and economic reasons. The data back this up. In 2025, the median age of a first-time homebuyer reached 40, according to the National Association of Realtors. Recent data from the National Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, analyzing the years 1990 to 2023, found that births to women 40 and over increased 193%. In 2021, the 40-plus demographic accounted for over 600,000 graduate students, according to the National Center for Education Statistics. That's nearly 20% of the total graduate students in America. Within that cohort, some 66% were women. It helps that we're living longer than ever. In 2024, the CDC reported that the life expectancy for an American woman is 81.4 years, and a woman in her mid-40s today has a much greater chance of living into her late 80s or early 90s than previous generations. That's an extra decade or two of a healthy, active life. My 40-something friends are training for marathons, opening businesses, dating, having babies, and changing careers. There's not as much pressure to have it all figured out by 40 if you know you've got another 40 good years to go. And while I won't go so far as to use a trite phrase like the 40s are the new 30s, well, you catch my drift. In recent years, adulthood appears to have stretched, creating many more possibilities. As such, in Hollywood, pop culture, athletics, and beyond, women in their 40s are finally imbued with Maine character energy. In 1991, a 45-year-old Diane Keaton starred in Father of the Bride. In The Odyssey, the 43-year-old Lupita Nyong'o plays Helen of Troy, the most desirable woman on earth. Kim Kardashian is 45, and her love life still generates just as much public fascination as it did 20 years ago. And last month, I watched the Serena Williams, 44, return to professional tennis playing singles at Wimbledon. She lost in the first round, but it didn't matter because she's 44 at Wimbledon. Her sister, Venus, 46, is still on tour too. They have not disappeared, and they're no longer expected to. I love this for our 40-somethings. My only note of caution: with a sense of endless opportunities comes the pressure to keep topping yourself. It's never too late, can start to feel exhausted. I'm thrilled for Hathaway and Portman, but I'm happy to be done with the sleepless nights of the baby phase. I feel physically older now than I did when I was in my 30s, even though I'm still in fine shape. Is that okay to admit? You can find inspirational quotes reminding you that 40 is just the beginning, but that framing is false and diminishes our not insignificant life experience. The beginning? I'm an expert over here. I was recently playing tennis when my opponent hit an unexpected drop shot. If Serena Williams can return to Wimbledon, I can get to that ball, I thought to myself. I'd love to say I won the point, but I missed the ball by a mile. When I was 25, I probably would have made the shot. At 45, I laughed and moved on. In Williams' statement after losing Wimbledon, she said she enjoyed the moment more than anything. Nothing lasts forever, which I know from my 45 years on earth. I'm not young anymore, but I'm not so old, so I'm going to take a cue from Williams and try to enjoy the moment. It's a helpful reframing for middle age. Given the realities of today, we should start calling it prime time. That brings us to the end of today's articles. I'm Merrick Schneider, and I will be back soon with more articles. Thank you for listening.